Maudling, tell me, a few economic cliches are now going round in my head as they have done for years. Is this anything to do with too much money chasing too few goods?
I think that was the Labour Party's cliche of 1947, but they rather tend to change with the times, as we all do.
But isn't it a fact that if you're going to pay higher wages and have fewer consumption goods, that is what happens? Is that right, Frost?
I still thought so, but then you must address that to Maudling.
I have addressed it to him, but I haven't got an answer which I can understand.
In other words, if you want more of one thing, you've got to have less of cut.
Are you suggesting, Maudling, that we should have cuts then in consumer goods generally?
I think we'll have to have cuts in consumer goods, because if the factories making pots and pans switch over to making aircraft parts, as they'll have to in the next few months, then there'll be less pots and pans, unless you can step up production very dramatically. Which, in any case, I think the shortage of raw materials at present prices will make quite impossible.
What do you think about this, Cross?
I think that's overstated. It's quite true that you'll certainly have cuts in things like television sets, motor cars, refrigerators, and the other things which you, Maudling, were mentioning. I don't doubt that at all. But my general point is that however much you argue about the figures, one can't get away from the basic fact that productivity is going up by a good deal every year. And therefore, although you may have cuts in certain sectors where you've got direct competition, certainly, with armaments orders, nevertheless, you'll still have an increase in production in other sectors just by the natural increase in productivity. So it isn't necessarily true, and I don't believe it will be true, to say that taking the home market as a whole, you'll get some significant fall in the number of goods in the shops.
Well, you know, this scares me. I don't believe we can have rearmament without tears in this country. I don't believe we can get the arms we need to face the size of the present Russian armed forces without feeling it, and feeling it pretty severely. I may be wrong, or I may be professional pessimist, but I can't help feeling in my bones that we're going to feel this rearmament if it is going to be a real and genuine thing.
Well, if you really feel that, and I certainly think we shall feel it, I don't think one can have it, of course, in an entirely painless manner, but I still do think, as I say, that there won't be any significant cuts, probably, in home consumption. But if you do feel this, I should have thought that you ought to go to the trade unions and say, well, now, look, in this situation, no wage increases at all. We must have an absolute wage freeze, say, and possibly increases in taxation and the like. That ought to be the set of conservative clichés in 1950.
No, I don't think of...
Rather, if I may say so, than 300,000 houses.
That's not a cliche. That's 300,000 houses, which is a very different matter, as we shall see if we have the opportunity. But I don't think to maintain a complete wage freeze is possible. I think it may well come to increased taxation. I'm not for a moment afraid of facing that. I think it must come to reduce government expenditure. And you've got to maintain a substantial budget surplus if you want to keep prices in check at all. I don't think taxation can go up by much. It may have to go up by little. I think the only answer can possibly come is reducing the expenditure side of the budget. The things aren't going to get out of control altogether.
Can it be done, Crossman?
Well, it depends entirely what Maudling means. It's very hard to say in those general terms. Clearly nobody disagrees with the statement that we must have economies if we can, and we must be looking for economies the whole time. But it's really very difficult to answer that point without knowing whether he wants cuts in the capital investment part of the government budget, or whether he wants cuts in the social services part, or what part he's thinking of.
Well, perhaps you'll amplify, Maudling.
Well, this is an old and familiar argument in politics in this country, and probably most other countries. No one wants cuts. Everyone wants to spend government money because it's nice to give people things or let people have things. But you've got to choose. If you're going to spend more on arms, I think you will have to cut down expenditure to some extent all round. I do think a point that is overlooked sometimes, Doctor, is that out of a total expenditure of about 3,600 million, a 5 or 10% cut in a number of directions produces a very substantial saving. But I think we must take much greater cognizance of priorities. If we put more emphasis on housing, school building will have to be slowed down and made more economical, and I'm quite convinced it can be. I think a lot is to be saved in the expense of building schools at this moment.
How do you take that, Crossland?
Well, I think that it came out in a rather harmless form in the end. Again, nobody would disagree that if we can find cuts of 5 to 10%, then let us by all means find them. But I think that you really must find them. It just isn't enough, I don't think, to say, oh, well, 5 to 10% doesn't sound very big. It's a big budget. They must be there somewhere. For instance, you say cuts in school building might be a good thing, might not. Very arguable point. But you won't get any cut of 5% if as rapidly as you decrease school building, you increase the housing program. No cut at all there. Extra 100,000 houses will cancel out a lot.
Well, of course, you always make the assumption, your chancellor did this afternoon, that if you're going to have another 100,000 houses, you must cut the capital investment program by the same amount. That I entirely disagree with, because there is already enough labor in the building industry, and I think adequate materials, except timber, there's certainly enough labor to produce far more houses without diverting any more labor from other capital projects. I think it's a really, not an unfair, but a misleading argument to suggest that more houses means that amount less of other things. It really means using the resources you've got more efficiently.
Oh, well, if you're saying that we're capable of a great increase in the efficiency of the building industry, of course, I entirely agree. I must make the point that it's an entirely private enterprise industry, which is under very little government control indeed. I think it's an industry whose productivity record is extremely bad. I agree with you entirely on that, and I wish we could find some way of increasing its productivity.
Yes, but come again, Mort. I want to say something on that.
The difference between the house building industry before the war and since the war, being owned and operated by a private enterprise in either case, but since the war, entirely to government direction, working almost entirely for local authorities, and productivity, as between those two times, in a private enterprise industry, has fallen by, I think, 15 or 20%. Perhaps we're getting rather off the main topic. I'm delighted to follow up housing. I think it'd be more interest, perhaps, to the domestic listener than to anyone else.
I think we're getting off the main point, which is rather a good thing, because I do think that your last remark is at any rate very challengeable on the reasons for the fall in productivity. Well, let me come back, if I may, to the main point, then. It may well be true that you can build more houses. It may well be true that you can do so without cuts in the non-building industry part of the capital investment program. But, of course, you can't build more houses in the short run without cuts somewhere. Now, if you're going to build more houses, all the cuts which you're going to make and which you say we must have are going to go into the extra houses. And what I still want to know is where the cuts are which are going to the extra rearmament as well as the extra houses.
Well, apart from that, the direct control or transfer, direct transfer of physical resources to the armament program will largely be from civilian consumption. We said television sets, pots and pans, motor cars and that sort of thing. The transfer of money from one form of government spending to another would involve cutting out such things as the famous groundnut scheme. I'm sorry to come back to this, but there is the best part of 30 millions of perfectly good money thrown down the drain, in my opinion. And that is only one example of many. One doesn't know all the examples until you're inside the government and they have access to all the facts. If you study the reports of the Committee of Estimates, you'll find plenty more. Enough, I think, to add up to 100 or 200 million without a great deal of difficulty.
Well, if the groundnuts is only one example of many, I'm bound to say the Conservative Party has wasted a great number of opportunities. Because, I mean, it seems to have taken the view on groundnuts that it was a scandal so exceeding any other that it's absorbed the major part of their attention for the last 2 years. I don't think, in fact, that I don't think myself we could now, in the short run, get much saving on groundnuts, of course, because the scheme has been cut down. But what I do think on the general point is that it's a mistake to suppose that even if you can get some more administrative economy, some more efficiency in the government departments, everything like that, I don't believe that the saving which you'll get from that will be quantitatively significant in terms of rearmament.
Can I say the word profits here without provoking violence, Modling? Is that an idea that commends itself to you at all?
Could there be a cut in profits?
I'm all for profits, particularly if I can earn them, which I very rarely...
I'm talking about a cut in profits, not profits.
A cut in profits?
Yes.
What sort of cut in profits? I'm a strong believer, as I imagine Crosland is too, in competition in private enterprise industry. And I think the best way of restraining profits, insofar as you want them to be restrained, is through competition, which enables the efficient chap to get a big profit and the inefficient chap to go out of business.
Well, I'm merely asking for information, Crosland.
Do you think there's anything in the cut in profits which might help the rearmament program to be financed?
I certainly think something can and ought to come from profits. I don't think that that's the sole answer to the whole question, but I do think the profits are now very high again. And if Maudling is right, and I agree with him to some extent, that you've got to have some cuts somewhere, he says that the cuts must come out of consumption. Personally, I would much rather that the cuts, if possible, came out of profits. And there's no doubt the profits are far higher now than a year ago, and I do think there's a strong case for increasing profit taxation.
Good. I think your Chancellor would be rather disappointed if profits fell, because at least 60%, and I should say in the long run, well over 60% of profits go to the Exchequer to help him pay for rearmament.
That is absolutely true, but the remaining 40% is very big still. And
I
think
doubt if the remaining 40% is adequate to maintain the capital requirements of British industry, and if you want evidence of that, look at the way enormous companies well-run, efficient companies are constantly having to go to the capital market to borrow fresh money these days to maintain their own working stocks and maintain their physical assets.
Oh, well, I don't think there's any shortage of capital funds in this country. After all, big companies in this country, in America and everywhere else, have traditionally got their funds by borrowing from the market.
But they don't borrow unless they need it.
No, that's quite true, but they've always borrowed it in the past. There's nothing new in new capital issues. They've been going on since the beginning of time. What is remarkable at the moment is how easily the new capital issues are being financed. The public is lapping them up. And I think that does suggest there's no particular shortage of capital funds in the country.
Well, I noticed that as money seems rather to move out of national savings, it appears to move into industrial issues. But, however, that's sort of a controversial point to raise.
Now, having started down this slippery slope of controversy, I shall throw all discretion to the winds and shall mention capital levy. Any reaction, Grossman?
I think the case for a capital levy at the present moment really is a psychological one. And not an economic one. A capital levy went from the economic point of view, helped rearmament a great deal. I would agree with probably what Maudling thinks about that. The psychological case, on the other hand, seems to me irresistible. More so if Maudling is right than I. If he wants cuts in consumption, and if they've got to come, it seems to me that you won't get the national support for the rearmament program unless you have some sort of levy on capital, which means a levy on the wealthiest people. And I think the psychological case for having, and therefore the political case, for having some sort of recurrent annual capital levy as long as rearmament goes on, is extremely strong.
You accept that argument?
Well, I think it's an extremely interesting argument. I gather Crosden agrees, or would agree with me, that the capital levy is economic nonsense, has no relation whatever to the financing rearmament. What, in fact, he's saying is in order to persuade people to pay the taxes that must be paid for rearmament, indirect as well as direct, you have to soak the rich. Well, maybe psychologically that is necessary. I hope it isn't necessary in this country, because I hope people still believe that burdens should be laid on people and taxes levied on them only insofar as that's needed, and not to satisfy perhaps the envy of other people who feel they're not as well off as they ought to be.
Well, I agree with that, but after all, it's been your main point tonight that there is a burden of rearmament. Mm. Well, now, if there is a burden of rearmament, it's just to me a simple matter of social justice that the people who should feel the burden first should be the wealthier people and not the poorer people. And so if there is a burden, and you agree and I agree that there has got to be some burden, we disagree about how much, it seems to me just a matter of simple social justice that the burden should first feel on the people with the large fall, on the people with the large capital fortunes.
Well, if the burden is a question of raising extra taxation and the capital levy doesn't provide the resources for rearmament, you're not spreading the burden at all. You're spreading the burden on one hand. On the other hand, you're sucking a chap behind the ear with a club because you think he's better off than he ought to be. It has no relation on your own admission to the economic side.
Well, now there's going to be one cut made here and now, I'm afraid, and that's a cut in time because we've run out of hours. And I think people who've listened to us will gather that if we've got no shortage of economic problems in Britain, we've got no shortage of remedies either. Whether the body politic can take them all is another matter. It may be that the British people will presently have to choose between the two sets of nostrums that are offered them. You ask me when will that be? Well, that's another debate, I think, in London Forum.
You have been listening to a discussion in the weekly series London Forum, recorded in a studio of the BBC. The speakers were Anthony Crossland and Reginald Maudling, with Edgar Lustgarten in the chair. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.